everyone. Anthony Fantano here, internet's busiest music nerd, and it's time for another edition of the Needle Drop Podcast, our weekly review roundup podcast, where we give you the best segments that we came out with in the past week. In this episode, we have, of course, an exclusive section from our Let's Argue series that you can't get anywhere else. We've also got a few Think PC videos, one about me reflecting on what's allegedly my unbearably white audience. I also have some thoughts on whether or not nine co-writers on a song, is that too many writers? Is that too many writers on a track? We've also got reviews from the latest records from Young Nudie and Pierre Bourne, Megan Thee Stallion, DJ Khaled. That one's not a very positive one, spoiler alert. Also, Flying Lotus, Rammstein, and Slow Tie, in my opinion, one of the best and brightest new faces coming out of the UK hip-hop scene right now. So that's going to be it for this episode. Strap in, get ready. Here we go. Ba-bam.
People should listen to universally hated albums with an open mind rather than asserting that an album is bad from the get-go due to reputation. The same logic of just because it's a classic doesn't mean you should like it should be applied to the reverse, but it often doesn't.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I mean, there are quite a few bad albums that came out in the past that, in retrospect, I think have aged well, or I think are pretty funny or pretty interesting, or are at least worth listening to because of how freakish or odd or unique they are. And because tastes and points of view change so much over time, it can be really fun and interesting to go back into the past and see what maybe audiences way, way, way back thought actually like qualified as awful music, and whether or not it can be maybe recontextualized into something interesting today. So I think the ultimate lesson here is, you know, listen with an open mind no matter what direction you're going in, and just, you know, see if something appeals to you without having to worry about whether or not everybody else likes it and so on and so forth.
Hi, 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 everyone. Anthony Fantano here, internet's busiest music nerd. I hope you are doing well. Thank you for tuning in. Let's talk about my unbearably white audience! Listen, guys, this may come as a shock to you, but I am white. I am a white man. And many of you out there are actually white too. Not all of you, but many of you. And I got a tweet recently for a Let's Argue segment that actually kind of grabbed my attention that I thought might make for an interesting topic of discussion. And this tweet, the sentiment of it, the question here in this tweet was actually echoed by a woman who showed up to one of my recent live shows, and we do a Q&A segment at the end of those shows, and the question she asked, again, was pretty much echoed here in this tweet. Sean here says, the name is Cold Brew Soy Milk. I was more surprised than I should have been to see that nearly the entire audience for your tour was young white males who like memes. Is there something to be said about diversity regarding this? P.S. In case it's unclear, I'm also a young white male who likes memes.
So my audience is full of white dudes.
It's an interesting observation. It's a true observation. It's true. It's a true thing. So I guess the question is, do I feel some type of way about that? And the answer is yes and no. And when I say yes, I don't mean in the same way that someone might have an issue with it if they were on the fake woke side of the political spectrum. Because at the end of the day, as a reviewer and as a content creator, I'm not intentionally trying to do anything to make my work or make my reviews appeal more to white guys or become less appealing to non-white guys or non-white and non-guy people as well. Okay, I'm not like putting on an album and getting ready to write it and thinking like, okay, how can I get this review to appeal to white dudes the most? How can I do that? Oh, it's so hard. What's the formula? If I could change the demographics of people watching my reviews in the same way that someone just like adjusts a fader on a soundboard, like I would, but I can't. And maybe I could alter the demographics slightly, or people's perception of the demographics, if I started acting or presenting myself in a slightly different way. But honestly, I'm me, and I don't want to be anything else other than me on camera. I just don't. I just want to be myself. I want to say what I feel, and whatever audience I get as a result of that is the audience that I get, and it just is what it is. And on top of it, if that audience ends up being a bunch of white guys, I don't see anything inherently harmful about that, because there are tons of other things out there on the internet that have a majority white audience and aren't necessarily a bad thing for having a majority white audience. But if there's anything significant to be pulled out of this factoid that my audience is a majority male, it's a majority white, it is this. And this message is being especially geared toward the white and the male section of my audience. Pay attention. Here it is. Representation is important. Now, I certainly don't mean to say this to argue that white people need more
representation.
And I certainly don't mean to tell any of the women or people of color in my audience that representation is important, because you guys already understand that, because you get how rare it is that you find a piece of media, no matter what the medium is, that you enjoy and means a lot to you, and you feel like it represents your identity. You feel like you see a piece of yourself in that media. Certainly that has gotten better in the age of YouTube and streaming platforms and Netflix and just the internet in general, but we're still very much in not a perfect world when it comes to this. But back to my white fans. Representation is important. I mean, I would like to think that people view me because my reviews are fucking awesome. For sure, that is a part of the equation here, but if you yourself were not a white, nerdy music dork, you would not be watching the white nerdy music dork show. Like it or not, that is an identity. That is branding. That is a presentation of me to you. And it's easier for you to buy into it and get something out of it because you identify with it. Now, again, identity is not the only line by which people decide to consume whatever media they consume or enjoy whatever media they decide they enjoy. It's not that black and white, and if it was, I wouldn't have any trans viewers, any female viewers, any viewers of color. Sure, maybe all the media that you consume day in and day out doesn't directly represent your race and your identity and your gender and so on and so forth. But for a vast majority of white dudes, that is the majority of your media diet. And I'm not coming on camera here to wag my finger at you and shame you and say, oh, you don't watch enough content creators of color, blah, 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 blah. All I'm really trying to get you to understand here is that when you see women and when you see people of color and when you see people who are in the LGBTQ community complaining or advocating about the representation of their group or their identity in a piece of media, especially a piece of mainstream media, please take that seriously and see that as significant. If you're a person whose identity is pretty well represented in all corners of media, it might be kind of easy to write off other groups' demand for the same, thinking, why does it even matter? Who cares what color the characters are? Why can't it just be about the story? But the thing is, at the end of the day, everybody is different. Every perspective is different, and every different perspective wants a place and a platform to be able to express their views, see their experiences validated, and also just a place to put individuals who have succeeded, put people who are icons in a certain community that allows people that are in that group to aspire to that position, to create that same sort of success for themselves. You may see a piece of your identity in my content in that you're a guy, in that you're white, in that you're a music nerd, in that you like some of the same artists that I do, in that you like memes, maybe we both have a similarly dry sense of humor, similar personality type, whatever. You could identify with what I do for a whole host of different reasons. It doesn't have to be entirely predicated on race. Case in point, the really great black drama Insecure, starring actress and writer Issa Rae. It's a really good show, and a majority of the actors and actresses on the show are black, and many of the scenarios and plot points that they deal with throughout the show are sort of based in their racial and cultural history, but a majority of the show's audience is white, and that's just because it's a damn good show. It's a compelling drama. Appeals and identities can also be generational as well. I'm sure a great deal of the audience for that show are also of the millennial crowd, and they identify with the millennial problems dealt with on the show. So in conclusion, yes, I guess my audience is male, my audience is white, but honestly, I'm not really all that surprised by that. Because at the end of the day, when I started this YouTube channel, I began it thinking, you know, what are the kinds of takes and views on music that I would like to hear, honestly? And it's not really that far of a leap of logic to think that the individuals that would gravitate toward that are individuals that are like me, even if they're not agreeing with every single thing that I'm saying. I think I'm going to leave it at that. And it's time for me to kind of talk about the sentiment in this article over here next to my head. And not to pick on this article specifically, I'm not going to dive too deeply into it, but I will link it to you down there in the description box so you could check it out for yourself. But the ideas and concerns expressed in this piece are ideas that I've heard thrown around in a lot of music conversations online. Now, the spark for this think piece over here is this song from a music project by the name of Rudimental. This track over here titled, what is it, These Days? Is that the name of the song over here? It's titled These Days, yes. And it features Macklemore, and not just Macklemore, it features quite a few people, but still, features Macklemore, sounds like a Macklemore song, pretty much plays through and formulaically is just like a Macklemore song, but we do have basically another voice, another point of view on the track, so it's kind of like a narrative duet in a way. And apparently this track has quite a few writers on it. And this is a very popular track that dropped very early last year. Miraculously, this article is my first introduction to the song. I was not familiar with it up until this point. But still, having said all of that, this question as to whether or not a song needs, does it really need nine writers? Again, I see this sentiment, this feeling thrown around in music conversations, especially when we do something like, let's say, look at the liner notes of the newest record from, I'm just going to say Beyonce. I'm not basing this off of anything other than just she's a popular artist. We look at the writer credits on the new Beyonce record and we see there's like three writers or three producers. Why are there so many writers on these songs? Why are there so many writers on a new Ariana Grande track? Why are there so many writers on a new track from some other new pop artist or some other new hit song that's climbing up the charts? Doesn't that seem bad? Doesn't that seem wrong? Doesn't that seem like we're losing artistic merit here because we're not seeing a single name on the writer credit of the song? We're not seeing a single person is responsible for the creation of this track. Doesn't that mean something? Doesn't that speak to the degradation of modern music and its creation? And previously, I never really had a strong opinion on this point of view, but the more I think about it and the more I see it persist, like in pieces like these, this concern, I just find it really annoying and really stupid and tedious, and I think it really adds nothing to the overall music conversation, because ultimately, does it really fucking matter if there's nine writers on a song? Does it really matter if there's 20 or 30 or 50 writers or even performers on a song? Does having more or less writers on a song give it more or less artistic merit? If the track ends up amazing, what does it matter? Does a piece of classical music have more or less artistic merit if it features a 30-piece orchestra as opposed to like just a string quartet? No, of course not. And most of the Beatles' best songs required every member of the Fab Four plus whatever producers they were working with at the time. Look, if anything is a concern for me, it's that we are often seeing trends in music move in the opposite direction because of digital audio workstations, because of easy-to-use production apps on your phone, because of all of this technology that allows us to make music by ourselves. It's really, really easy to create music in an isolated state. When previously, when people wanted to make music or make grand music or make great music or make dynamic or make layered music, they needed to collaborate with others. Collaboration is not an inherently bad thing. I mean, sure, part of me is impressed when I see something like the new Billie Eilish record and I enjoy it and I look at the production credits and I see, wow, this whole thing was written and produced by her and her brother. That's it. That's kind of unique and rare to be in such a closed space for such a large-scale pop album with a lot of fans and a lot of traction and a lot of attention. But still, the only reason that is interesting is because the music has already passed the threshold, in my opinion, of being good. If I thought the album was shit, I wouldn't really care whether or not there were two people writing and producing it or if there were 30 people writing and producing it. And look, guys, I'm handed demos week in and week out in my inbox. I review albums week in and week out on my channel that are made by one person, two people, three people. And sometimes they're shit. In fact, after reviewing thousands upon thousands upon thousands of records at this point, I personally have found no correlation between, well, is a song good because it has less people writing it, or is a song good because it has more people writing it? So much more goes into a good song than how many people were in on the writing process. Ultimately, the answer at the end of the day to this question of, did this song really need 9 writers? Well, I don't know. Is it good? Yes, it's pretty good. I like the song. Well, then the answer is yes. That's how many writers the song needed to be good and resonate with the listeners it is resonating with. If the song is bad, maybe it didn't need 9 writers, but chances are, if the track sucks, a lot more is going on than just how many people took part in it. In fact, as the listener, viewing the artistic merits of a song through the lens of the liner notes is a pretty shallow and reductive way to do so. Because here's the thing, while the liner notes and the production credits can tell you some things, especially if you're familiar with some of the writers and producers that appear on a given track, still, liner notes and writer credits don't provide any real insight into the creation of a song. It doesn't provide any real insight into how the sausage is made. Liner notes and writer credits don't
always
tell you who contributed the most to a song, who contributed the least, what they contributed. At the end of the day, you don't really know, and honestly, this is far more preferable to the situation I typically see a lot of writers and producers in that I've talked to. They have some creative input on a song, and they get literally no credit whatsoever for it. Considering how normalized this practice is in the music industry, I would much rather see more writer credits than less. So again, in summation, I don't really see the amount of writers on a track as a big deal. There are some instances where it can be interesting and cool to look at if you think a song is particularly good, and there are some instances where the writer credits are kind of surprising. Like, let's say if I pulled up Wikipedia right now and for whatever reason I learned that Daft Punk's Get Lucky required 12 people to write it, maybe I'd be sort of perplexed as to why that song of all songs would require 12 people to write it. But still, I mean, if that's how many people it takes, that's how many people it takes. I think I'm going to leave my rant here at that. You guys are the best.
And it is time for a review of the new Pierre Bourne and Young Nudie record,
Slime Air.
Young Nudie, an Atlanta rapper with a growing profile and some interesting connections. He is the cousin of 21 Savage, and on this new project over here, he is linking up with one of the most in-demand producers in the game right now. Known for his minimal and funny and subtly psychedelic beats all over Playboi Carti's Die Lit, Pierre Bourne doing double billing on a record with just about any rapper right now is going to gain attention. Though this is far from the first time he's worked with Nudie before, as he's given the guy tons of instrumentals on his Slimeball mixtape series, on his Nudieland project. The connection between these two guys runs long and deep. But honestly, I see the relationship as being sort of one-sided, as the instrumentals make up for the majority of the appeal, the majority of the time, on any given Nudie song. For me, Nudie's greatest strength, I guess, is that he doesn't distract all that much from the good qualities of the instrumentals. Pierre's playful and cute melodies, his hypnotic and simple percussion, it sort of strikes a vibe, but outside of that, I don't get what's so interesting about this project. Nudie's flows on this thing aren't exactly coherent or consistent. Sometimes he's barely even on the beat, like Blueface, but without even a fraction of the charisma. He's just another one of these rappers who comes in sounding incredibly faded in the booth. I mean, it's kind of a giveaway when you put out a mixtape titled Faded in the Booth. And look, it's not something I'm inherently against. There are plenty of great artists that do it, but I don't think it's necessarily to Nudie's benefit on this record, as he's vocally just wandering over every beat here. And he's not incoherent in the same way that an Uzi or a Future or a Thugger feature might be, where the lyrics aren't quite as important as just the feeling of the performance those artists are giving. Honestly, most of what Nudie is saying on this project here is pretty easy to read and decipher. I say Nudie's performances on this record are incoherent because he's so far from saying anything notable or anything memorable that he might as well just be speaking in
made-up
language. And it's not just a lyrical thing either, because his performances, his rapping, his delivery on this project is shockingly underwhelming. Sounding high out of his mind on this thing does lead to some moments where he doesn't have that many inhibitions, so some weird and funny vocalizations and inflections will kind of slip through, but his performances aren't nearly as dynamic or as expressive or as intoxicating, energizing as any of the other rappers currently operating in this minimal, psychedelic, weirdo lane of trap right now. Playboi Carti being the most obvious comparison. Not to mention every feature on this thing
commands
at least 2 times more attention than he does. Megan Thee Stallion, DaBaby, Lil Uzi Vert, 21 Savage. Across the rest of the record, there's not a whole lot to report. Once you have the formula of the first few tracks, you pretty much know what the rest of the album's gonna do. The shouty overdubs in the background of the track Black Hippie White Hipster are kind of weird. You don't hear that every day. The beat on Sunflower Seeds is particularly sad. That certainly makes it stand out in a good way. And the synthesizers throughout the track Dispatch are warped and eerie. They almost sound like something out of the Undertale soundtrack. I could keep listing, but nearly everything that stands out to me on this record has directly to do with the instrumentals and the production. Honestly, I just see this album as another submission in the current paradigm of the skeletal, surreal, and somewhat trippy trap albums with lyrics that are a little directionless, which isn't a bad thing if the songs come out intoxicating, if the songs come out exciting. But this one is pretty unfulfilling in that regard. Even though Nudie seems pretty off the deep end on a majority of these tracks, very little of that actually translates through the songs and his performances. Though I will say Pierre did kind of kill it on a lot of the instrumentals here, even if the incessant producer tags and Jamie Foxx samples he throws all over this thing kind of kill the vibe. Overall, it's fine when it's on, but I don't really see what about this record is going to draw listeners back to it once the trend that it's following is over. I'm feeling a strong 4 to a light 5 on this.
Transition into the next review.
And it's time for a review of the new Megan Thee Stallion album, Fever. Megan Thee Stallion is a Houston rapper and one that I have a somewhat hard time describing because she pulls a lot of inspiration from many different places. For one, the album cover over here is very dramatic, intricate, and obviously inspired by blaxploitation films. Her unbreakable attitude on a lot of tracks reminds me of legendary female MCs such as Lil' Kim. Megan's smooth and catchy flows, especially the ones that ride along the lower end of her vocal register, remind me so much of Missy Elliott. Megan is also a Southern rapper through and through, which can be heard in the Juicy J feature on this thing through the multiple 3-6 Mafia references and samples throughout this album, which can be heard in the obvious Gangsta Boo and La Chat influence on her delivery, on her raunchy lyrics. Also, Megan's hooks and instrumentals on this thing are pretty straightforward trap, from the sub bass to the crisp snares to the rattling triplet hi-hats. But the take Megan has on the genre seems way more in touch with its roots than some bastardized internet-era version of it. Megan's songs are more like something you'd hear blasting out of a slab car or a Houston strip club, and not so much like your buddy's SoundCloud page, as much as the internet has blurred the lines between those two things. You could easily slip the song Simon Says on this record into a DJ set between songs by Masta P and 3-6 Mafia and Little John, and it would just work. There's also the matter of Megan's personality, her message. On the surface, it might seem like a lot of threats and posturing and aggression and sex, though even without further
analysis,
Megan already shines on all of these fronts. She already sounds more ruthless than a great deal of male rappers trying to sound hard on tracks today, and she's also an unapologetic freak that just oozes sexual appeal. The only rapper out there right now hitting this hard that is raunchier than Megan, in my opinion, is maybe Cupcake, though a lot of the time Cupcake's X-rated lyrics border more on parody, especially in the case of tracks like Squidward's Nose. For Megan, though, her exhibition is more like a serious show of her dominance and power. Whether she's showing her total control over men or a specific guy, or she's showing her lack of need for one. Like in this one set of bars where he's asking, oh, are you trying to trap me with like how good this sex is? And she's like, no, just go, leave. Hottest out, but you already knew that. Even if I brought him to you, still couldn't get your boo back. I ain't finna argue with you. This ain't how we do that. You was already mad. I'm just adding something to that. Hey. That's cute. That's fun. That's fun. I also love this next set of bars where she might be hearing this dude bare his soul and tell his secrets and she doesn't care. But when she's talking about, she's like, oh, okay. Hey, now we're talking. A topic I'm interested in. Also further down the line, when she's sending dudes pictures of somebody else's boobs, That's pretty funny, too.
Also, this next set of bars, damn, I want some head, but I chose the dough instead. I can never let a dude fuck me out my bread. Ain't no dick alive that could make me lose my mind. Every dude that done tried still be crying on my line. Is like some of the catchiest stuff I've heard all year. This same track, in my opinion, also kind of dives into the blaxploitation film theme of the cover with how ridiculous the juxtaposition is on the hook of you hearing Megan wanting to get her
eaten,
but simultaneously blasting this dude's face off with a sawed-off shotgun. Yeah, that's like what a lot of exploitation films are, just like sex and violence. There's a good chunk of tracks in the track list here where the thrust of the song is very much Megan's sex drive and her ability to just wrap men around her finger, the song Cash, Pimpin', Sex Talk. And then there are spots on this thing where she comes off more cold-blooded than any gangster rapper operating today, whether it be Hood Rat shit or the song Weak Ass Bitch, which is a track all about people talking shit on the internet, and when you meet them in person, you just vaporize them.
Crush them between your fingers!
Megan packs some seriously infectious aggression into this track, along with some hilarious one-liners. One about, rubbing her pussy on a dude's forehead out of disrespect for this chick. It's way out of pocket. In the middle of the record, Megan does slow it down for one track, the track Best You Ever Had. And given the aggression, given how in your face a great deal of this album is, you wouldn't think that this would be Megan's strength, that she would pull a track like this off well. And yet it's somehow one of the best songs on the entire project. The short laid-back vocal line on this cut is catchy as hell. It's a perfect earworm. The beat is intoxicatingly groovy with its kick snare pattern, as well as the woodwind sampled in it. The lyrics are still pretty rated R, but they're flirty, they're fun, they're sexy, they take on a more romantic tone. He say he feel intimidated when he talk to me. I got that hardcore, but he want that R&B. Meanwhile, the track Simon Says is one of a few songs on here that sounds like hundreds of asses shaking all around you in every direction. This is also kind of the case for the song Dance, as well as Ratchet. Megan's simple but effective hook on this track is absolutely addictive. Simon Says, put your hands on your feet. Simon Says, bust it open like a freak. No question, Megan has contracted whatever virus Southern rappers have, where they're all just so freaking good at penning these perfectly repetitive but also addictive, and they just sear themselves into the back of your brain choruses. She comes through with these on nearly every track on this thing, especially on Money Good. There's also a lot of very simple but quality song structure building a lot of these songs up too, with Megan's verses contrasting very well from her choruses. Not to mention Megan's delivery on a lot of these tracks is bulletproof as well. She's expressive, she's mean, she's animated. She is a total character that just jumps out at you and demands your attention. I will say there are a few weak spots in the track list here. For one, the closing track being a freestyle, even if it is a decent one, is a little anticlimactic. The song Shake That is far from one of the harder and more memorable tracks in the track listing here, not to mention that I think it shares a lot in common instrumentally and vocally with the song Cash, which is a far superior song. So Shake That pales in comparison and feels redundant. The song Big Drank is a scissorp anthem whose tune and instrumental combo is maybe the weakest of the entire record. Even if once you dive into the lyrics, there is certainly something revealed here, as Megan is not the person drinking the purple drank. Rather, it's her boyfriend or her significant other, and she doesn't like to see what he turns into when he's on the stuff. Which, frankly, is a kind of refreshing point of view, given all of the lives in the industry we've lost and lives that we've seen ruined due to recreational cough syrup drinking. Overall, I like this project a lot. Yes, sometimes it is a little too on the nose in the case of tracks like Ratchet, as well as the opener Reeler. Songs that are so meat and potatoes concept-wise, you can't really stretch them out all that far. But truth be told, even though Fever doesn't leave a whole lot up to the imagination, what it does provide is actually kind of titillating and full of replay power. It's irresistible, it's fun, and even if there aren't a whole lot of in-depth narratives on this record, most of what Megan does, lyrically, it does paint a character portrait. One that's pretty bold and powerful and confident. But honestly, that's all just a side dish to how frickin' catchy this album is. I'm feeling a strong 7 to a light 8 on this thing.
Transition into the next review.
This DJ Khaled album, it's not good. Father of Assad, DJ Khaled. New album, DJ. Music industry titan. Social media star. Living meme. You know who he is. He has a new record out. And many of you may come into this video not at all surprised that it's not good. But it really is. It really truly is not very good at all. And it's somewhat maddening. Who DJ Khaled is and what exactly he does is pretty well established at this point, even if there are some people who still look at it and they're like, wait, what is he producing? No, that's not what DJ Khaled is or what he does. He's more of
a curator
of sorts, a mover, a shaker, a director, somebody who basically grabs and funds a bunch of rappers and singers and producers coming together on a track of his imagining, and they just kind of, you know, have at it. They all take part. Somehow a song just comes out of it, and sometimes it's actually a hit song. And when DJ Khaled does manage to
mastermind
a track that climbs up the charts, I mean, I have all the respect and understanding in the world for the dude and what he does. But the thing is, DJ Khaled himself is not exactly a singer, he's not exactly a songwriter, and as a result of that, he does tend to put out a lot of BS, and I think that's especially the case on this new album over here. It is very trendy right now for rappers to be guiding these large-scale, very collaborative projects that involve a lot of input from a lot of different people, Kanye West and Tyler the Creator and ASAP Rocky and so on and so forth. Travis Scott as well. Cannot forget Travis. But the thing is, that's been DJ Khaled's MO since like forever. Maybe on more of a micro scale, maybe he's more of a singles man than an albums man, but still, it's what he does. However, the quality of the songs on this new project, they are awful. They are terrible. There are tracks on this thing that there is just no rhyme or reason to them. They are a total fucking traffic jam. The opening track is a key example of this. So many performers, so many singers, the track is like a reggae flip, and it's a total goddamn mess. It's like in a perpetual state of booting up and introducing. Like, it never reaches a moment where it feels like, okay, the song has officially started. You have that. You have tracks on here that are merely passable and feature a very generic trap instrumental and a couple of lyrical performances from people who really should be spending their time elsewhere. Cardi B and 21 Savage on the track Wish Wish. Travis Scott and Post Malone on the track Celebrate. Got to highlight the fact that Travis's hook on this one is, again, he's been dropping a lot of garbage lately on his features, and I mean, it's not hard to see why. The dude's probably paid tons of money just to show up and vocally riff with some auto-tune and reverb on his voice. If that's what I was getting paid to do, that's what I do too. The track Big Boy Talk featuring Jeezy and Rick Ross isn't bad either. Feels like a Bling-era throwback. Some decent performances from both of these guys, but it's still a criminally short and underwritten track that there's not really much at the core of outside of, hey, I've paid these two guys to appear on a song and I've gotten a random instrumental under it, here you go. Then there's songs on here where DJ Khaled has had past successes with these artists in almost the same genetic makeup, and it's like he's just trying to see if lightning will strike twice in the same spot, like on the song Top Off with Jay-Z and Future and Beyonce. Khaled already did this track. He has I Got the Keys, but this song is never going to be a hit because the Future feature sucks and the mix is shit. We also have the song No Brainer with Justin Bieber, Chance the Rapper, and Quavo. Does it sound familiar? Yes, he had that same exact lineup sans Lil Wayne on the track I'm the One, which is an infinitely better track, not only because the hook is pretty sweet, the instrumental's better too, but it was also kind of cute and novel the first time around hearing them all together. Now it's just like, why are we here again? There are some other tracks here where the combination of features doesn't really make any goddamn sense. Freaking You with Lil Wayne and Gunna is absolutely redundant and totally pointless. Meanwhile, Meek Mill and Lil Baby on Weather the Storm. I will give it to Meek. His performance and his lyrics on this track are pretty invigorating, pretty great. He's definitely a breath of fresh air on this album, but he makes absolutely no sense with Lil Baby on a song. They have two totally different styles that are not
complimentary.
It's just a combination of two dudes who are popular by a man who doesn't really seem to have much in the way of taste when it comes to combining people.
If Khaled applied his talents for assembling people together on this album to, let's say, romantic matchmaking, he would create some of the worst relationships in all of human history. For sure, there are a few bright spots on the record. The CeeLo Nas coupling on a track here is pretty great, and the Nipsey Hussle feature and the John Legend hook on the song Higher is actually great. Nipsey's lyrics and his performance here are heartfelt. John Legend's vocals are incredible. The grand piano-infused instrumental is glamorous. It's powerful. It's uplifting. But outside of that, I can't really say anything nice or interesting about any of these tracks. Jealous with Chris Brown is absolutely generic. The song Holy Ground, like the intro cut, is hugely inspired by reggae music, but it's, I guess one of the better tunes on here comparatively. I still think some of the vocals are slightly rough and the production is kind of cheap, but it's not as bad as that damn Post Malone and Travis cut, I guess. Yeah, this thing is really a hot mess, and I'm not sure what to say about it. There's very little in terms of anything likable and enjoyable on this project. I didn't even get into the track with SZA, which is literally just SZA vocally riffing over the damn instrumental to Miss Jackson, but it's not the authentic instrumental. It's like some kind of terrible bastardized version of it. It's like what you would get if you went into YouTube and typed Outkast type beat. But yeah, that's garbage as well, which I don't put on SZA. I don't think it's SZA's fault the song is terrible, and I don't think the responsibility of these songs being bad is put on any one of the features here necessarily. Most of them are either just showing up for the check or phoning it in, or they're just here for like the songwriting credit or something. It's DJ Khaled that has assembled this musical Frankenstein monster and thrown his damn name on it. I think this record is reflective of a few different things that I'll say right here. One, I will forever be surprised by how great the industry is at thrusting mediocrity up. And I'm not talking about the same kind of artistic mediocrity that might drive a Taylor Swift song. No, this is really like on a new level. It's a different kind. It's really no different than Donald Trump like slapping the Trump name on a fucking ugly ass building. That's literally what DJ Khaled does, but just on a musical level. Because he didn't build the building, he didn't draw up the architecture, he just passes the buck on that over to people who clearly don't care all that much about the artistic integrity of what they're making. It's really more about how relevant the song is going to be or whether or not the track is going to sell. So, you know, you just appear on a song from a DJ Khaled record because it's truly no skin off your ass, and you'll probably be paid pretty nicely to do it, so whatever. Yeah, this album, it's not good.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcasts, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
And it's time for a review of the new Flying Lotus album, Flamagra. This is the long-awaited sixth album from legendary producer Stephen Ellison, a.k.a. Flying Lotus. A lot of anticipation for this one, for me. Mostly because I've been enjoying Flying Lotus's music for a long time. Since the days of Los Angeles, which is over 10 years old at this point, and that's very weird to think of, so I'll stop that now. Ellison's music not only revitalized, but recontextualized and reinvented the dynamics of instrumental hip-hop. He was vital in the popularization and inception of the wonky genre, and in a very short period of time founded a groundbreaking label, Brainfeeder Records, and inspired an entire generation of left-field producers and rappers. It's also pretty amazing that he's been able to evolve so boldly from one record to the next. The trailblazing Los Angeles, which saw Ellison crafting this hypnotic, awe-inspiring lo-fi hip-hop way before anybody was anime studying to it. The progressive and otherworldly Cosmogramma, considered by most of his fans to be his masterwork. You have the subtle and moonlit Until the Quiet Comes, which in his discography contrasts very well with the incredibly explosive, bold, and kaleidoscopic You're Dead. So where does a man who's always turning up somewhere new go next? That's a hard question to answer, especially considering the crop of singles and teaser tracks from this record. We have an eerie spoken word cut featuring David Lynch, songs that have Anderson .Paak as well as Denzel Curry on them, where Flylo can be heard doing his best to sort of put his own spin on an instrumental that really complements their respective styles. There's also the matter of surprise appearances from Tierra Whack as well as Shabazz Palaces. And of course, some of the usual suspects turn up on this record too,
like
Thundercat. So again, pretty hype for this thing, especially since it's Ellison's longest album yet. It's 1 hour and 7 minutes, which is spread amongst 27 tracks. And now that I have heard it, and I am ready to review it, I have to say, it's Flying Lotus's weakest album yet.
No! It hurts to say. It burns the tongue. It's like bleach in my mouth.
I think the easiest way to explain my feelings is that this record completely fails on nearly every front that Flying Lotus's previous albums succeed on. Are we handed a cohesive, seamless set of tracks that reinforce each other's creativity with a central focus or theme or flow? No, absolutely not. This thing is loaded and just packed with so many random ideas and fillers and detours that there's really no rhyme or reason to much of any of it. It's like sitting through a bunch of arbitrary load screens where I'm just waiting for something of substance or significance or interest to pop up. Compare the dodgy, inconsistent progression of this album with the nonstop thrill ride of You're Dead, and you will hear a night and day difference. Even Los Angeles and When the Quiet Comes, while these records may not have exciting progressions across the entire track list, they do have focus. They are immersive. Listening to them transports you to another place because these albums have a sense of place, whereas this new album just really has no true identity. So if Flying Lotus doesn't do that on this record, does he at least present us with a new idea, direction, something groundbreaking? I would have to say no to that too. This album mostly feels like a hodgepodge of ideas that he's already explored on previous efforts, with a few unexpected experiments and features thrown in that are pretty hit or miss. I mean, you do have the surreal and twisted genius of Fire Is Coming with David Lynch. The tale told on that track is actually kind of cool. And then you have Pygmy, which sounds okay. It's a vibe, it's a motif, but not much else. It's kind of like a bit of a beat jam, a beat chill out inspired by a Jungle Sounds relaxation tape. Say Something, surprisingly enough, is a 3-4 piano and string piece that sounds straight out of the Eastern Bloc. It's kind of enchanting, kind of elegant, and not at all congruent with literally anything on the album. The most annoying and tedious thing I've heard in a while definitely goes to Yellow Belly featuring Tierra Whack. And it's not even Tierra Whack's somewhat repetitive and absurd performance on the song that ruins it. If anything, it's one of the few appealing things about it. No, it's actually the rickety-ass instrumental that sounds like something any Bandcamp producer could pull together in about an hour. Which brings me to my next question. Is Flying Lotus even living up on this album to the quality standards that he set for himself on every record up until this point? Am I consistently impressed on this album with the sound play, the sound craft, the beat assembly? No, not really, not at all. You know, it's not the case with every single song on here because the quality and the style of these tracks is so varied and so unpredictable, but some of the mixes on this album are god-awful. Layers of instrumentation that just blob together hideously, making it difficult to decipher exactly what's going on. The worst offender on this front is easily the intro to Anderson .Paak's More. Then there are tracks on this thing where Flying Lotus uses way too much reverb. And look, on his previous efforts, Flying Lotus is no stranger to reverb. He uses it. But I've never heard him use it to the degree that, like, a bad indie band that can't write a song does. I would say the tracks where he's most guilty of this tend to be the cuts that have some lead vocals front and center. Debbie Is Depressed, Spontaneous featuring Little Dragon, the George Clinton cut. The reverb also feels like it's doing double duty on these tracks too, trying to cover up how horrid some of the singing is. Also, 9 Carats with Toro y Moi. It's difficult to even make out what he's doing vocally because, again, so much reverb. The vocals and the overall sound of the track are just hollowed out. There's also the matter of some of the instrumentals here not bringing that strong of a groove, or packing in sounds that feel really flat and basic and cheap, like the track Heroes in a Half Shell or the very goofy Pilgrim Side Eye. And given his previous output, some of the beats on this thing just feel completely beneath Ellison. The FF4 instrumental literally sounds like a generic lo-fi hip-hop anime study beat instrumental on a YouTube channel. And look, there's nothing wrong with that sound, there's nothing wrong with that style, but does Philo put his own spin on it or anything? No, I mean, it's just like a 1-minute throwaway that should have been left on the cutting room floor. It just seems like literally anything is just making it onto this record. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some beautiful highlights on this thing. It's nothing new for Ellison, and it's pretty low-key, but the track Post-Requisite is a smooth, groovy, wonky rager with intergalactic sparkly lead melodies, sputtering drums, jazzy synth chords. It's great. The track Remind You features this very winding and starry and harmonious jazz progression that could have fit somewhere in the Cosmogramma track list. There are some mind-expanding string arrangements in the second leg of Land of Honey featuring Solange. And the climb featuring Thundercat is great as well, even if it is a little guilty of an overuse of reverb. It is one of the more solid tunes on the record here, and it could easily go toe-to-toe with any number of highlights from Thundercat's past couple of albums. There's also a very touching but short instrumental tribute to Mac Miller on this thing too, toward the end. So there are some very good tracks here, but with a lot of them being as short as they are, their impressions are not that large. And none of them really get a chance to reinforce each other because they're all surrounded with these supremely mediocre cuts. It's very sad to say, but this album does not present the inexplicable rush of beauty, the incomparable attention to detail, or the mind-expanding explorations in sound that Flying Lotus is known for. I'm feeling a light 5 on this thing. Transition
into the next review.
Ooh, ha ha! And it's time for a review of the new Rammstein album,
Untitled.
This is the newest full-length album from one of Germany's biggest bands of all time, Rammstein. One of my favorite bands when I was younger, Rammstein is one of the few groups from my adolescence and my teen years that I could look back on pretty fondly. As their biggest projects to date, like Sinnschutt and Mutter, as well as Reise Reise, have all aged fairly well. You could say the band had a pretty great run from 94 to about 2004, but they have had a hard time staying relevant and cutting edge with the slow fall from grace that new and alternative metal had in the mid and late 2000s, as a lot of the band's fan base was gained through exposure on traditional media outlets like American Rock Radio as well as MTV. It's actually miraculous the band got as much traction as they did, considering their weird alien presentation and the language barrier. But I think that just speaks to how good the band's music was during their peak of relevancy. They just had this weird knack for dark, dramatic, dance metal ragers that no other group at the time did. I see Rammstein's 04 record Reise Reise as a bit of a breaking point. I'm not surprised after this album that the band hit a bit of a creative wall. It may not be my favorite album from them, but it's definitely their heaviest and most crushing, to the point where I think they lost their groove a little bit on this album, as a lot of the tracks on this thing were smothered in these somewhat slow arena-sized guitar riffs. After this project, it's not surprising the group would go right into a record like Rosenrot, where they essentially started penning even slower, even more brooding material, most of which I could really just take or leave. It's not a god-awful album, and up until this point, Rammstein has yet to release a project that is absolute crap. And there were some pretty great instrumental climaxes on this project, especially on the cut Hilfmeer. But without their edgier production and dance music roots, I wonder how much appeal Rammstein really has for me. Rammstein's follow-up album in 2009, Lieb ist für alle da, is often hailed by fans as like a bit of a return to form. But considering the thunderous production as well as instrumental bits like the whistling solo on the track Rottersand, it's pretty much just an extension of the previous two albums. But here we are now, 10 years later, with a new album. The band also excited fans with a pretty great debut single from this record, Deutschland. Being no stranger to social commentary as well as taboo subjects, of course, this single was attached to a very colorful and very controversial music video depicting all of these symbolic renditions of Germany's finest hours as well as greatest horrors. The lyrics of the song explore the cognitive dissonance of being proud of who you are and where you're from and your heritage, but simultaneously acknowledging all the terrible things that may be packed away in your country's history. Vocally and instrumentally, I'd say the song is pretty Rammstein by the numbers, with its rave synths and driving kicks and heavy guitars and Till Lindemann's very theatrical and authoritative voice. But still, it's easily one of the best written singles the band has released in like two decades. Radio is also a pretty fun track on the album, definitely a poppier take on the band's usual form. Sounds like something that would have made more sense to release back in 2005 as a last power grab for pop appeal as the modern rock radio well was drying up. I love the subtle Kraftwerk influence on the hook of this thing. The lyrics are pretty intriguing, depicting someone that sounds like they are from East Germany before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the music and the radio this person has access to is limited, so the music they want to hear on the radio, they have to sneak away and listen to it in secret. The grand chorus of singers on the track is pretty stunning. Same thing with the crushing thrash riffs on that same song as well. If you've been listening to Rammstein for a while, the track Ausländer is a song that really you just have to shake your head at. It sees the band bringing back the dance music influences of their early years back in a big way, but now with a more grand instrumental presentation like on Risa Risa. The crushing riffs on this track sync up pretty tightly with the 4-4 kick drums, the growling bass line, the synths on this track kind of whoop like something you'd hear out of an EDM festival. However, the song is attached to this cartoonish and kind of tasteless display of colonialism, making it seem like it wasn't really as destructive as it truly was. The lyrics of the song, though, don't seem to deal directly in this, though. It's more about world travel and sleeping with people that you meet in other countries that speak different languages. And again, to a newcomer, this song and this music video might seem like a uniquely weird perversion or something, but if you've been listening to Rammstein for a while, you know that just about half their discography is based on some kind of sexual antics, and sometimes that can drive them into making a tasteless or a cheap song. Speaking of which, we have the fifth track on this album, Sex, which I'm surprised it's taken Rammstein this long. I'm actually kind of blown away we're not at Sex Part 3 at this point. And yeah, the song is about sex, and lyrically it's about as on the nose as you would expect, to the point where I'd say it's obnoxiously basic, especially with its low-brow bar band guitar riffs roaring throughout most of the mix. After this point, though, the band starts whipping out more turgid, long-winded ballads like we're back into Rosenrot territory, and the results are mixed. Even if we do get tracks such as the harrowing Puppe, which features some pretty incredible vocals. I mean, the screams on this thing are throat-shredding. It's a totally manic performance. The heavy drums on this track as well are incredible. The synthesizers take on a very eerie John Carpenter-ish vibe. The following tracks, though, do get pretty underwhelming, though, even if some of the singing on Diamant is pretty dramatic. After that, Weitweg, in my opinion, is maybe the weakest and blandest song Rammstein has ever written and recorded. The mid-paced riffs on here and drums have little to no soul or groove. The guitar solo on the track is absolutely boring. The synths sound like something out of a bad prog song. Tattoo, instrumentally, is another very formulaic track for Rammstein, but it does not have the benefit of being one of the better written songs here. The lyrics just seem like a very humdrum poetic tribute to being tattooed and not much else. However, we do have an incredibly twisted closing track on this thing, where lyrically it seems like we're being told a story about maybe a kidnapper who sexually abuses their victim and then maybe leaves them to drown in the ocean. Every single bit of progression in the narrative here is not spelled out exactly, so some of it is left up to interpretation, I guess. But it does seem like a pretty dark and disturbing story. And again, if you're familiar with Rammstein's history, putting out a track like this at this point on the album is not really all that surprising, as unsettling as it is. My biggest issue with the track, though, is really that instrumentally it does leave a lot to be desired. It's nearly as bland as every other track on the back end of this project. Overall, I thought this one was a pretty okay return after 10 years, although I guess I shouldn't be too surprised that it came out just so-so. It has been a long time, not only since Rammstein has put out an album, but also a long time since I think they've put out a mind-blowing album. Yes, unfortunately, this one, in my view, does trail off pretty quickly after the first leg, and especially around that midpoint, so... I'm feeling a strong 5 to a light 6 on this one. Transition
into the next review.
And it's time for a review of the new Slow Tie record, Nothing Great About Britain. This is the new breakout debut album from up-and-coming UK rapper and grime artist Slow Tie, a guy who I have been hearing a lot about lately, whether it be through the amazing Flume feature he had on the latest Flume mixtape, or the a little bit of background vocal work he had on the recent Tyler, the Creator project, Igor. There also seems to be this general buzz about him on the internet at the moment about how he is making such a huge impact on the UK hip-hop scene. And after listening to this record, it's not hard to see why. He has a bold, uncompromising rap style, very yelpy and expressive. I would say he is not too unlike a young Dizzy Rascal. In fact, before this album is even a minute in, he refers to himself as a boy in the corner. Given the Skepta feature on this project, the numerous regional references throughout the lyrics, as well as the driving, industrially tinged post-punk rap on the song Doorman, which sounds almost like a fall song, Slow Tie seems pretty in touch with the UK's modern musical roots. Familiar enough with them to deliver this raw, dirty, ragged, punked-out version of the original form, displayed with a pretty wide array of attitudes, emotions, and instrumental styles. The depth and the breadth of this project is pretty wide considering it's just like 30 minutes and change, with a handful of slightly rougher bonus tracks tacked onto the very end. While this album may be short, it's still a fresh breath of smoggy, foggy air straight out of a Britain that is in the throes of social and political turmoil. The tracks on this thing are soundtracked with rugged and chilling instrumentals, embracing the usual instrumental suspects of UK hip-hop and grime and two-step, but with a slightly unsettling vibe to it. Listening to these tracks sounds like existing in a forever moonlit urban dystopia, which is just marinating in Slow Tie's despondence, his soul-crushing snark. His negative outlook, which is painted by rising out of a state of supreme uncertainty and personal trauma. Sure, there are some tracks that go hard on here, some bangers like Inglorious and Grow Up. Not one of the best tunes on the record, but its vicious attitude and the chemistry between Slow Tie and JK certainly makes up for that. Meanwhile, Inglorious, featuring Skepta, is one of the most sinister and catchy bangers to come out of the UK this year. Great hook, devilish beat, dark, distant, church-style organs thrown into the mix. I should maybe also mention the thrilling bonus-cut Drug Dealer, where Slow Tie delivers this rap verse that is absolutely manic. I'm not going to dive too deeply into the bonus cuts on this album, and certainly the core of the record is quality enough to where the bonus cuts aren't 100% necessary, but they are there, and for the most part, they are very good. A great deal of the tracks on this album, though, come more from a place of emotional stress, and again, trauma. The song Missing comes to mind, which features this fevered and intense monologue that essentially boils down to this incredible fear of just not feeling like yourself, going crazy and losing your moral compass and not having a sense of yourself, and having a hard time working through all of it and making sense of it even with the aid of therapy. There seems to be a lot of anguish in Slow Tie's past and his present as well, and he's not shy about diving into that, especially on the closer Northampton's Child, which is an autobiographical cut, where Slow Tie is detailing a lot of what brought him up to this point, a teenage pregnancy, a poor family,
family, drug abuse, a younger brother who passed away not too long after being born as well. Also keep in mind Slow Tie's performance, his delivery, his rapping at this point is incredibly compelling. He is somebody who performs and delivers his emotions through his lyrics, through his rapping, very well. Slow Tie also references the stress that he gains from his surroundings, as well as his rocky family history on the track Peace of Mind, which he says in the track he can only gain by either sleeping or pretending he's living someone else's life. It's also worth mentioning the lovesick, soulful, and twisted crack. The tone of the song is given away right with the opening line, "I love you like a crackhead loves crack," like a combination of a 50 Cent and an Old Dirty Bastard line. The track is, of course, about a relationship that features a lot of distrust, a lot of lies, but also a lot of dependency, too. It doesn't sound all that good. In fact, it sounds very volatile, but there's something sort of sweet and endearing about it as well. It's a very strange mix of emotions that Slow Tie pulls off very well with a very authentic bite. I would say the opening track, Nothing Great About Britain, as odd as the groove of this track is, it sets the tone of the album perfectly. It's got a very choppy, sporadic beat, a synth bass line, and this very digital foundation is built upon with the cinematic rushes of strings and piano. Slow Tie on top of this instrumental is ranting and raving about what sounds like him kind of phoning it in on an existence of quick fixes, cheap food, massive wealth inequality, inability to control his emotions, political stressors like the rise of the EDL. It's very much an album that acknowledges the idea that we are products of our surroundings, and that is borne out in the line, "I'm a product, yeah, they made me," on this track. I would also say the song has some perfect closing lines as well. "Nothing great about Britain, tea and biscuits, mash, jellied eels, and a couple little trinkets. East End, you Phil Mitchell, get stabbed with a Phillips. Hand on my heart, I swear I'm proud to be British." In a way, the song does seem to display at least a modicum of genuine pride where Slow Tie is from. Maybe it's out of a bit of self-preservation or something like that, I don't know. But many of us do show favoritism toward where we are from, even if it is kind of an asshole. Again, to go back to the instrumentals on this thing, most of them are pretty killer. I love the glamorous and pretty piano loops all over the track, gorgeous. The acoustic guitar samples laid out all over the cut toaster are pretty nice as well, even if some of the reverbed synth lines that come in later on the track feel somewhat out of place. To go back to the song Missing, the instrumental here sounds like the very intense soundtrack to a total mental breakdown. The burst of sound on the hook is not only powerful, but it feels like falling forever into a deep, depressive abyss. I wish there was more lyrical focus as well as just overall song length to the track Dead Leaves. Meanwhile, the outro to the song Gorgeous just drags on so long. I do feel to a degree the whole project is a bit too scant for my liking, and I do leave this thing feeling a little confused as to why more of the bonus cuts couldn't have just made it into the original album, especially since some of them are so good. Still, though, I do think this project does represent an exciting new face and sound for UK hip-hop. Slow Tie is undeniably great at translating his own personal hardships as well as the struggles of disenfranchised youth in the UK right now through his songs. Not only that, but there is a huge, 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 like, emotional and mental health angle to this record that should be greatly appreciated. And I think I'm going to leave it at that. I'm feeling a light to decent 8 on this thing.
And again, thank you very much for listening to the Needle Drop Podcast. Once more, it is Anthony Fantano here, your host. Make sure to follow us over on youtube.com/theneedledrop and youtube.com/Fantano to not miss a single piece of content that we drop. We also have, of course, social media engagement for you to take part in over at twitter.com/theneedledrop, afantano on Instagram. You can also hit us up in our email portal at theneedledrop.com. I want to give a shout out to Jonah for assembling this episode, as well as he does every episode of the podcast. And make sure to, whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on, write a review, leave a rating, subscribe, helps out the show, and we will see you in the next one. Anthony Fantano, the Needle Drop Podcast, forever.